Mini episode 730 of the FDH Lounge is brought to you by Sportsology, delivering unconventional columns and webcasts about sports, TV, music, movies, and more. Follow them on the web at sportsology.com.
The FDH Lounge. You want to schedule your life around it.
A long time ago, on a gloomy, wet Cleveland spring night, two men stand alone amidst the late night drizzle. Their voices echo across the vacant station parking lot as they debate the merits of the great American radio show that have been missing for far too long. On that night, an idea was born. That idea became the FDH Lounge. Welcome to the FDH Lounge.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to FDH Lounge, mini episode number 730. This is FDH Managing Partner Rick Morris. We are privileged to put together today a fine panel to discuss the 2016 TV upfronts. We have addressed these, I believe, every year on the show now since 2010. As always, we have an amazing panel and a lot to talk about, so let's get right to it. We have a good friend of the show, Stuart Elliott, longtime New York Times columnist, now columnist with Media Village, covering TV basically more or less from the advertising perspective and how things are progressing over there. So, Stuart, welcome back to the program. Always a privilege to have you on.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Good to have you. And also, we have longtime friend of the show, in fact, a longtime FDH Lounge dignitary, also of Media Village, and the fine Tomorrow Will Be Televised brand of both podcasting and columns. Great friend of the show, Simon Applebaum. Been on multiple times and multiple times for this very subject. Simon, a fun time with you as always, my friend. Thank you so much for making time for us today.
It's a pleasure, Rick, and great to be on with both you and Stuart, my colleague at Media Village.
Absolutely. We've done this before with you two guys, and this always flows great. Let's get right into it. There's so much to be able to get to as far as this year's coverage. And, of course, when we talk about the upfronts, we are encompassing as well the new fronts that largely preceded them. Those, I understand, tend to go a little bit earlier in the cycle. I'd like to start with a quote from one of your columns, Simon. I'll start with you on this one here because I think it goes even more expansive than the way you even intended it when you were talking about when you were at the YouTube up front and you had the quote, "It's a YouTube world." I am thinking it goes even wider than what your column was discussing there. You were discussing it in terms of specifically the material they were putting together and their growing preeminence in this industry. But in terms of, we were talking a little bit about this off air, this whole esports phenomenon, which I'm sort of crediting, if you want to use that word, them with to a large degree, as far as the way that watching people play video games has been such an explosion the last couple of years on YouTube, and you now have networks like TBS getting into the esports arena and ESPN to a certain extent. Please address this from your perspective here, the way that you initially intended when you said it's a YouTube world in terms of their power and their preeminence, but also their influence on other companies as well.
Well, with YouTube, two things, Rick. One is there's no question that they have now fostered a whole group of talent, a pool of talent that has galvanized Generation X, Gen Y, millennials, any demographic group 30 and below that you can think of. But the other thing, too, is that YouTube is getting more involved with television, that we're now seeing YouTube stars being put into television series, whether it's Grace Helbig with E!, the experiment you with the talk show last year, whether it's other PewDiePie, whether it's other ventures. You're seeing them all over the place on late-night talk shows, whether it's Stephen Colbert, Jimmy Kimmel, Jimmy Fallon. They're all over the place. But something else is happening, too, that YouTube and other Internet services are part of, which is this. We are now in, I think, an era where more and more of the American public is watching television through a smart television set or a smart television device like Roku, Google Chromecast, Amazon Fire, Shield. Plug-ins, streaming sticks, whatever you call it, they and TV sets from the likes of Samsung and Vizio and so on have become now the way that people watch the Internet. That's how they watch Netflix. That's how they watch Hulu. That's how they watch Amazon's programming. That's how they watch Crackle, et cetera, et cetera. And that's also how they're watching YouTube. And that's why YouTube now has a service called YouTube Red, which the idea is to bring their stars and to give them the opportunity to participate in scripted television. And you could say that the combination of YouTube, but even more importantly, the smart TVization of the American public and what they are watching beyond broadcasting cable is why we are seeing the boom in scripted television that we are. YouTube stars and other internet stars getting into scripted and unscripted TV on broadcast and cable. Why we're seeing more services that are called direct-to-consumer, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And I think this is a trend that, frankly, we are not covering as much as we ought to. I think this is big, a trend in consumer electronics, as drones, as wearables, as Internet of Things, because this is impacting how people watch. And it's also showing that people are not cutting the cord. Contrary to popular opinion, the millennials and those underneath them are not cutting the cord. They may be watching television on a smart set rather than through their local cable service, but they're not cutting the cord. They are watching through the television set, not the personal computer, not the smartphone, and not the tablet. And I think at the beginning of what we're going to see, where we're going to see interactive television happen, where we're going to see other things in terms of e-commerce. We're now seeing with Apple TV, for example, which has its Worldwide Developer Conference next week, we're going to see things like Airbnb and Zillow and Priceline and other internet commerce sites get more involved in terms of using the television to have people market the product.
Very good points. And in terms of the interactivity, I have to say, again, I have greatly enjoyed my Roku stick. I got one for my dad for Christmas. Even he kind of likes his. So they really are having an effect, as you say, in these areas. I think I'm atypical of a lot of people in that I still enjoy watching stuff on a tablet as well. But you're right. That's a big thing for people to be able to watch it on their TVs. And in terms of all of this, Stuart, what I want to ask you about is, from the advertising perspective, is there a great sense that there is a maturity of this industry as far as these folks coming into the mainstream? These channels can get fairly easily monetized on YouTube if they're big enough. I mean, they don't have a problem making money in that ecosystem. But are you getting the sense that there's more and more ad dollars flocking their way as they're coming towards, quote-unquote, more mainstream properties like regular television?
Oh, yeah, absolutely that's happening, but it is a slow process, and there's a lot of backing and forthing and toing and froing. It's very hard for the advertisers and the agencies to give up the current advertising system because for decades and decades, regular television has been the most effective advertising medium in the history of media. And clearly they all understand that if consumers are changing their habits, if they're going to change the way they watch television or watch video, whatever you want to say, they're going to have to do something about that, and the money's going to have to follow the eyeballs. But in many cases, it's a complimentary kind of advertising buy because people are not giving up television per se. They're maybe augmenting TV with using their smartphones and their other devices or their laptops or whatever. So there are a lot of questions still in terms of where the money's going to go and how fast it's going to be moved around and in the end, how much is going to be left back in legacy television? And I think it's going to take a while for all that to sort itself out.
And something else to follow up on, Stuart, we're also seeing a lot of the new front players think of themselves as TV players. Hulu, when they had their event at Madison Square Garden Theater, which had 2,000 people catch it, they built their thing as an upfront. And in addition to the fact that they were launching new series, they also had something that, believe it or not, a lot of people did not promote, which was interactive advertising. For the very first time, starting this fall, they will run interactive messages where you can buy time on Hulu, and you can do it in such a way that if you want more people to find out more about your product, you can click them onto a web page that they will see on their smart TV set.
You know, it's
their smart device.
It's very ironic that years and years ago, the before the internet, the feeling was that interactive television was going to be the vehicle by which advertisers were going to get beyond television commercials. And there was a famous speech at an advertising industry conference by the guy who was the head of Procter & Gamble at the time, who was very negative, very critical of the advertising industry for not getting on the internet interactive television bandwagon. And his feeling was is that the industry wasn't sufficiently up to date and moving ahead with this important new medium. And not long after that came the internet, and that really wound up being where all the action was. And interactive television is only now getting attention and notice. But it's very ironic that originally the feeling was is that Madison Avenue was missing the boat on this new form of video that was going to replace TV, but it wasn't the internet. It was interactive television.
And now, Rick, there is a threshold, because we're hearing that as much as 70% of the people in this country have a smart TV set or a smart TV device. We're not talking the 30%, the 40%. We are now talking up to 70% of the 10 out of 10 people in this country have a smart TV device or a smart TV set, and that is it's a universe changer. And I think a lot of people are going to start looking at this and see what can we do with interactivity. Going back to that developers conference, Apple TV next week, if Apple really poses with Apple TV, which I understand now is in like 10 million households, the new Apple TV 2.0 was introduced last year, that Tim Cook says the future of TV is apps. If those hundreds of thousands of app developers get their imaginations going and they start to really give us some apps, look out, baby. This is going to be a universe changer, and I think you're going to see a lot of players in the internet really focus more on television. And those smartphone and tablet developers are going to adapt very quickly what they're doing, whether it's games or e-commerce or interactive services for the tube. One other thing, too, about the importance of YouTube and internet players. You know, one of the talks about the scripted TV movement that you hear a lot from people in the industry is, oh, well, we don't have enough talent to make it go. Baloney. We have talent to make it go. The YouTube people and the folks have been weaned on the internet, making all those internet videos. That's the talent that is now starting to come into television. Plus, we're seeing people from the independent film world, from playwrights, from theater, from books, who are now not only getting the opportunity to create shows for television, but they're running the show. Case in point, Mr. Robot. Case in point, Guilt, which I had Catherine Price, the creator executive producer, on my show yesterday. First-time talent in television. Never did TV series before. Next Monday night, she gets her own show through Lionsgate on Freeform, formerly ABC Family. And we're seeing more and more examples of newcomers to television who are getting the chance to run the show. So that TV program, whether you find it on Netflix or on NBC or on A&E, they have a distinctive look, they have a distinctive vision, and I hate to tell the people who think are naysayers about this, but this scripted TV train is moving, and it's going to keep on moving.
Well, that's a great point, Simon, and I have to say, I mean, that's an excuse that just makes me want to vomit when I hear it, and anybody that says that is not qualified to be in the position they're in if they say there's not enough talent out there. As somebody who's something of a creative entrepreneur, I will always say look harder, because I know a lot of people who are qualified to be doing a lot more than they are presently. So you're absolutely right about that as far as the talent pool that's out there that's just waiting to be discovered. The other, I had another topic here that was somewhat revolving around technology, and I feel like we should stay on it since we've been talking about that a little bit thus far. And Simon, this is specifically from your column that you did about the Hulu upfront, and then you touched on it sort of in a separate column as well about virtual reality. You said that virtual reality is en route to becoming reality. This is something that really kind of interests me, because when you look at these technologies that really, really haven't taken off the launch pad. I had to look this up today to see what year the movie Disclosure came out. It was 1994, and we're still not to the point of really doing some of the virtual reality things they were talking about in that movie. I remember around the turn of the century being out in Vegas at one of these arcades wearing a clunky virtual reality headset to try to do some boxing, and that was a game that didn't really seem like it was as far along as it could have been. So virtual reality has been this untapped promise for such a long period of time, Simon. I can't possibly imagine what it would be used for in terms of some of the shows that the new fronts and the upfronts have been talking about here. So please break that down for me and for everybody else, what the application of it might finally be.
Well, virtual reality, simply put, is you are at the center of the program you are watching. Literally, the program is revolving around you, whether it is news, scripted, documentary, game show, video game, etc. You are in the center of the action, and the action is going around you, and you can use your remote control, your smartphone, your tablet, or a device like a Samsung Oculus or Gear VR, etc., to do it. And you can move it up and down, side by side, diagonally, any which way you want. That's what we call virtual reality 360 programming. The thing is that, first of all, at these new fronts, there was not one single new front I went to where either a VR programming wasn't named or someone was saying we're going to form a VR lab. Whether it was Pop Sugar or Activation Blizzard or Machinima or whatever. The trick is that you can now do VR programming on the television set. Going back to Apple TV, last year, one of the apps that came out late last year, which I had a chance to see, and we showed the case on our program, is called Little Star. They're based in New York, and they have a way where they can put videos from the likes of the New York Times, the Discovery Communications, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, on the television set, and you use your Apple TV remote, very small remote, to flip where the picture goes. You know, horizontally, vertically, diagonally, it'll go any which way you want. Now, play both sides of the fence. The programming that they're using to go on the television set is also available on these headgears and these helmets, like I said, Oculus, NextVR, et cetera, et cetera. The interesting, and by the way, Apple will tell you, from what I've heard, that this is one of the most popular apps of any kind. Now, the question is, as we see more virtual reality programming, and as we see these devices like Oculus in the marketplace, the question is going to be, you, the viewer, how are you going to manipulate the reality? Are you going to do it through the television set, or are you going to do it using headgear? And is it worth it to buy the headgear, or the helmets, or the goggles, or use a Google Cardboard? That's the big multi-million-dollar question, and I don't have an answer for that yet. But I can tell you that you can play both sides of the fence, and maybe it might end up that both sides of the fence are going to win. But I think it does show that virtual reality does have a future on the television set.
That is pretty fascinating. And, of course, whenever we're talking about any of this kind of stuff, Stuart, it's always one of these kind of things of looking at a torturous process in terms of monetizing it, because the ad community has to, first of all, get its mind around exactly what's going on here, figure out how to get involved, where it's worth putting their money. This doesn't sound like a process that would be solved anytime soon, even if it's very exciting technology. I could see this, just from my layman's perspective, being something where the advertisers are sitting there going, okay, how do we get in and try to make the most of this? Where should we be putting our money?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it repeats. History just keeps repeating itself over and over with the radio and television and VCRs and DVDs and DVRs and the internet and will virtual reality, will it be a sponsorship model? Will it be an advertising model? I mean, look what happened with the web, where so many consumers are unhappy now with the pop-ups and pop-unders and ads that start playing the audio when you don't want them to, and all the other things, and all the spam and all the other terrible things that have ruined the user experience online. It's going to be a big issue, I think, as future technologies come into being, is to kind of, for the advertisers to remember that they mucked that up so badly, and they want to try to avoid that. Look at what ad blocking has done to online media, where the advertisers are tearing their hair out now. They don't know what to do. They ruined the experience for so many people. And, you know, are they going to do the same thing in virtual reality and turn it into an annoying advertising medium that the average person is going to take the goggles and throw them away, throw them as far and as fast as they can to avoid all this terrible advertising clutter that's followed into this new medium? You know, I think that's to me that's a big issue, and I hope this is taken into consideration, as well as the idea of, oh, you know, what technology and compatibility and what about the different types of formats and so on and so forth.
And so this is a great point, Rick, which is I think is another big thing that came out about the particularly of the upfronts, which is we can't have clutter the way it is right now. We cannot have primetime television where 15 to 20 minutes of an hour's of programming is advertising and promos. The audience is turning it off. That's why they're going to Netflix. That's why they're going to other places, which have either zero commercial time, in the case of Netflix, or limited commercial time, as in the case of Hulu and other services. TBS and TNT on their new series, less ads. Naturographic Channel, whatever new shows they do this fall and beyond, less ads. Saturday Night Live, two ad pods cut. I think you're going to see more and more of it. The question is, will the ad industry go forward with it all? Will they finally, you know, put their heads in and say, we've got to do this, because if we don't, TV is going to be less of an ad medium because people are going to turn it off because you cannot go, I think one message that really hit loud and clear from the upfronts and particularly from the ratings this year so far is people do not want to see a prime time with 15 to 20 minutes of ads on a network every hour. They want more show, and they want the ads to run differently, and they want the ads to be more creative, and more importantly, they want more show because they're getting weaned on a Netflix and so forth where you get the show, you don't get the ads. And it's going to be a very interesting dilemma. It's going to be a really interesting next couple of months to see how the advertising community, are they going to be united behind this, or are they going to just let the experimenters do the experiments and then make the call?
Well, Simon, your sense of anticipation is uncanny. That's literally the next thing I was going to ask you about. Maybe we've just been doing this many times, you can anticipate this and where I'm going to go with stuff here. But no, I was going to ask you both about this because, again, your column about the clutter busting that Turner was talking about, it struck me because that was a topic that, of course, Stewart had addressed as well, that he had seen from the upfront. So from the advertising perspective, Stuart, you heard Simon's thoughts just there, which I agree with pretty much right down the line. This is the kind of thing that almost kind of seems utopian, which I think to a lot of people should kind of make us suspicious in terms of less ads but more impact. So companies are theoretically willing to pay more for them. The consumer doesn't have to sit through as much of this. Again, truly utopian if it works out this way. What's your early sense of how the ad industry is looking at this and the sense of scaling back, again, this barrage of advertising in terms of making it more targeted and the shows easier to get through?
Well, I would say that there was, you know, once upon a time there was a utopia. I mean, it was a Garden of Eden, even if you want to use that sort of a metaphor in terms of, you know, the early days of radio and when radio was an entertainment medium and the early days of television when in the 50s and or into the early 60s, you had limited breaks. You had more content. You had the sponsorship model where the advertisers owned the programs together with the agencies, and the programs were created for and by the sponsors, and it was by no means a totally wonderful situation because there was a lot of hard selling and there was a lot of annoying commercials and complaints about bombast and about the hard sell and so and such, but if you watch, go on YouTube and watch an old TV show, it's just, you're flabbergasted at how few commercials there are. A 30-minute show, there's maybe, you know, three commercials, four commercials during the show, and in some cases, in many cases, the commercials are seamlessly integrated into the program so that you don't even notice that that there's been a commercial until it's over in a lot of instances. My feeling is that they've got to go back. The advertising industry has got to go back to that model in some way, shape, or form, or they are just going to completely kill the goose that's been laying the golden eggs all these years. Because the ability of the consumer to avoid advertising, to get rid of advertising, to keep advertising away from him or her is has never been more powerful, and there must be something done about this. Otherwise, the whole system is going to collapse. You're going to run into circumstances where there'll be ad blocking everybody will want to block ads, not just the younger tech-savvy people who are doing it now. If you think the media are going to have trouble financing their entertainment and information programming and content, just think of what kind of problems that will bring to the news media and the entertainment media when they try to create programming and there's no money in the kitty because they've alienated the consumer so much that advertising is no longer a use an effective is no longer effective.
And you look at the length of an ad break. If you see those mm-hmm. classic shows on YouTube, the length of an ad break was either 30 seconds or a minute. That was it. Back to the program. Back to the credit, you know, et cetera, et cetera. You had more show. You had credits that ran that you knew who was doing the show. And for the most part, it was a system that worked. And in some cases, Stuart said, the content was the advertising was integrated with the content. Take a look at an early Burns and Allen show where Gracie Allen and George Burns are talking about Carnation evaporated milk. And actually, it's a fun spot. It works in the plot. Or Jack Benny's talking about State Farm Insurance or Lucky Strike Cigarettes. And again, it's integrated very well into the plot. It's very seamless. And it showed that it can be done. And yeah, I don't know if we can ever go back to the 30-second break, 1 minute a break max, but we have to go somewhere. One interesting thing, by the way, Crackle is going to try something interesting along that line this fall, where when they come back with the second season of their critically acclaimed series, The Art of More, they're only going to offer 5 ad messages a show.
Hmm.
And if you're an advertiser, if you want to buy those spots, you can buy one of those spots for all 10 episodes. You get that spot, you get where that spot is placed, and you also could get other things like, say, maybe extra material, maybe work a plot in, that kind of thing. But I need to see who decides to take that interesting break. That's 5, I believe it was like 5 1-minute messages at the most. It'll be interesting to see, again, who decides to take that, and then will we see more things like it.
Clearly, they're getting a lot more sophisticated about how to do it. And, again, I've had some friends that have kind of whined to me a little bit, even some folks that themselves are aspiring content providers about sitting through ad breaks and everything like that. And I don't get into arguments with them when they do, but I'm thinking in my head, you know, what do you think supports the system, basically? Where do you think the money's coming from here? So there's a certain amount of maturity that has to be called upon from the viewing audience as well, just because there is no free lunch. But, yeah, it's incumbent upon the ad industry as well not to try to, you know, throw away whatever goodwill is out there and put people through too much. I have another sort of macro-level question about the industry that I want to pose to both of you guys. I'll start with you on this one, Simon, because some of this kind of pertains to your column about the Turner up front here. I've been getting a sense, I'd be interested to see if either of you guys agree with me on this, that we used to live in a world where the networks were very broad and cable channels tended to be more narrowly focused. And I'm starting to see, in my mind anyways, the pendulum kind of swinging the other way in both regards. It first kind of hit me a year ago when Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt ended up on Netflix, a show that very clearly looked exactly like an NBC sitcom. They passed on it for the reasons of controversy, but you now have it on Netflix. And it seems to me networks are getting a little bit more narrow in terms of how they're defining themselves versus I'm looking at some of the cable channels out there. Look at TBS. So there's the esports thing that I mentioned before, Samantha Bee's show that she's doing. They're going in a lot of directions that they really haven't gone before. So I'll start with you, Simon. Is this really a trend where some cable channels are getting more broad as some of the networks are potentially getting a little bit more narrow?
It's not a new trend, but it is a trend. And yet TBS, which was the very funny network, still is to a great mm-hmm. deal, is experimenting with things. You could say that by doing March Madness, you know, they finally ran the NCAA basketball finals for the very first time in history of television, and did quite well with them, by the way, that they are doing experiments. Esports is another example of that. And by the way, Full Frontal, contrary to what a lot of people will tell you, is not a late-night show. It is a primetime show. It runs at 10:30, which probably mm-hmm. would get that. And that itself is an interesting experiment for TBS. It's not the normal sitcom that TBS has run for years. In fact, TBS is really doing a lot of interesting experiments in comedy. Andrew Tribeca, where they ran the full season in one weekend, nonstop. I think they did the second one recently, or they will do it in commercial-free marathon fashion. They're trying some different concepts. They're trying it from different producers. So they're either experimenting with who they're getting the shows from or the type of shows that they're doing. Same thing with TNT. They're staying in drama, but they're trying to do more quality drama, high-ended, shades of gray drama. It's not the procedural like Brazilian Isles, but things like Animal Kingdom or The Alienist with Kai Fukunaga from True Detective fame and Beast of No Nations that will have a more you might say dark look, dark tone, more multi-layered, not everybody is good or evil, everybody has flaws kind of thing. And I think you're going to see that a lot more because, again, we're seeing more types of scripted television get on. I do think that there is something that everybody is going to have to watch out for, which is this. If you don't do an upfront event or you don't do a press event, you, because of this great panorama of television that's out there, you may get lost in the radar screen. And there were so many networks that didn't do an upfront event that you wish they did. You wish WGN America did. You wish Spike TV, which had a wonderful upfront last year, did. Viacom is in a situation where Nick has an upfront every year. Comedy Central, which had an upfront for years, I thought did one of the very best ones this year, where no executives were present. It was all talent at Town Hall, one of the biggest laugh rides of the entire year. And Stuart, you were there for it, I believe, also. It was an amazing thing. But then what about A&E, which just had one of the biggest projects they've ever had with Roots on History Channel, and they did nothing. So History got lost in the shuffle. Viceland, their new network running for H2, got lost in the shuffle. And I think it's going to become more and more of an issue, which is if you don't do something that provokes public attention, you may get lost in the radar screen. And that is not a good thing, especially when you want to be a success.
Very surprising that some of those channels did not. Particularly because, again, this is theoretically your best opportunity of the year to grab the advertisers, get them excited about what they got coming up next year. So this question, Stuart, I'd like to turn it to you in terms of it seems like there's some upside and some downside with some of these cable channels when they're taking this approach because, again, it would seem like it's a way to get the advertisers excited if they're broadening out a little bit in some ways in terms of avoiding becoming stale, which is a death knell in TV, but you have to do it in a way, obviously, where the advertisers aren't a little bit worried in terms of, uh-oh, are you steering a little bit outside your wheelhouse by taking this on? So it would seem like that's kind of a balancing act when you're trying to pitch yourself going a little bit broader to some of these advertisers than you've been before.
It's beginning to look like a situation where there's just such a vast array of choices now for the advertisers. You've got broadcasters trying to narrowcast, and narrowcasters trying to broaden, and you've got the online stuff, and you've got all the different different options for streaming video and everything else. I mean, it's sort of like the golden age it should be the golden age for the advertisers because, you know, theoretically there's every conceivable way by which they can reach every conceivable kind of audience, narrow, broad, in between, left-handed bowlers who like to wear red clothes and once lived in Cleveland and, you know, every conceivable target now seems to be there for them. Maybe it's the paralysis of choice where there's just so many different ways to reach people, or maybe it's that, you know, the measurement issues are still with us in terms of it's still dicey it's still a question mark how many people are actually watching anything or seeing anything and what kind of bang the advertisers are getting for the buck. So, I mean, there's all of that out there. I mean, in a funny way, you know, back when there was just three TV networks, it was a lot easier. If a show got a 30% of the audience, that wasn't good enough. It got canceled.
Right.
Because it was supposed to get 40 or 50%.
Exactly.
Now, God, 30%, it would be the slam bang hit of the year. So, I don't know. I mean, in some ways, again, the idea of these new going back to what used to work in the past might be a way to deal with these issues in terms of trying to make a case and to make a case for yourself and to cut through the clutter.
And something else is that these events, these upfront events and new front events, are no longer just an advertiser deal. It has become a public deal. These events and how Stuart and I report them and other journalists too, because the press now gets the chance to go to many of them, they have now become maybe the way that the public gets to see or hear or know, here is where this network, whether it is NBC or TBS or TNT or National Graphic Channel, et cetera, this is the way the network is at now and this is where it's going. And that's what I'm saying to go back again. If you don't do these events, if you don't reach out to the press, if you don't reach out to the public with all of this incredible array of programming we've got there now, and it is not going to get easier, If you don't do these events, or you don't focus these events in some way that the press gets to the public with what you're talking about, you are going to fall off the radar screen. And it can be really, really deadly, especially, as I said, we're going to see a lot more programming from a lot more different players.
Absolutely. It's a very, very strange marketplace out there, increasingly so, as everyone is kind of jockeying here. And in many ways, as always, a copycat one. Last question I have for you guys, actually submitted a nice teamwork here from within the FDH Lounge family. Good friend Ben Chu, an editor of that NBALotteryPick.com, he noticed, and by the way, he's earned a plug for this by giving me this great question. As far as I can tell, the first live Periscope comedy show out there, check it out, hashtag Basketball Detectives. You can find it at that NBALotteryPick.com. Ben's question to me, I did not know this, was that he had counted three separate time travel shows. They're going to be on the lineups next year for networks. And, Simon, this seems to be apropos of nothing to me. I must be missing something because I don't know what would be triggering something like this. So is it just a matter of they're sitting there and they got charts in their offices and noticing that we haven't done this in a while? Is it that cyclical of a business or is
no,
there something
that,
specifically
that,
triggering it?
It's that show on Stars. What's it called? Highland?
Highlander.
It's that show on Stars being such a big hit.
Okay.
As soon as one show becomes a hit, they all rush to copycat. Also, The Man in the High Castle on Amazon Prime, which isn't time travel per se, but it's counterfactual history. So
alternate history. Okay.
Yeah,
okay.
I think that's the genesis of it.
Great point. That's what I get for not having Stars. Okay, but you're right. All right, so that at least provides an answer in terms of that. And, Simon, what are your thoughts on the ways that these are likely to be executed on the different platforms next year with the networks trying to go in these directions and try to be a part of this trend?
It's going to depend on the execution. First of all, I wonder what the family of Owen Allen has to say, because one of my favorite shows growing up in the 60s was The Time Tunnel. And I think ABC let a good show get away, but to be very fair, I think Owen Allen, unfortunately, didn't do the show the way that it could have been done. And I would love to see that show come back with some terrific people at the helm. You still need the talent to do it. I think it's going to depend on the execution, and it's going to depend on what else is out there. We have also reboots that are coming up, reboot of Lethal Weapon, reboot of The Exorcist. I'm curious to see how that's going to go. NBC has a show called This Is Us, from Disney Captain Power, which I think could be the sleeper of the year. And then you've got a whole batch of shows that are coming up this summer and fall. Keep your eye on ABC's experiment later this month of three game shows back-to-back-to-back on Sunday nights. Celebrity Family Feud, followed by the $100,000 Pyramid, followed by Match Game, the latter two being produced here in New York. I'm going to make a bet that if their Sunday night schedule, which has really been tottering the last couple of years, if that falls apart this year, I would be very surprised if they don't go to that format, if it works. And we'll see if, starting in a couple of weeks, whether this three-hour back-to-back could bring the game shows back. But ABC's making a very big bet on this being a situation. And three other things to keep in mind very quickly. One is diversity. I think you will see definitely more diversity all over the map on through the upfronts, the new fronts. We saw that. Spanish-language television, by the way, keep your eye on it, because we are starting to see some very exciting developments with Spanish-language TV. Less on the telenovelas, more on different types of shows, more networks doing more different formats, and maybe, just maybe, this will be the year that Telemundo and NBC Universal will put the Olympics on in prime time in Spanish language television. I think if they do, and the sense I get is they will finally do so, it could be a very big winner. And the third thing to keep an eye out for is, again, more new shows run by newcomers. That's a huge trend to watch. And we're going to see more of it, whether it's from networks like USA, TNT, TBS, Nat Geo, et cetera, et cetera. I think, by the way, USA has got some very few shows in the pipeline. Look out for Queen of the South coming up on June 23rd, the English language version of The Rey del Sur, which was a Telemundo hit with Kate Steele several years ago, and also a show called Shooter, which is going to go on after SmackDown goes live in July. So I think USA Network is definitely a network to watch this summer.
Absolutely, and shout out to my good friend Ryan Ward, who is going to be at the writing helm of the live SmackDown here. I am looking for great things from him because he is a genius. And along similar lines, I have to say, not necessarily a Spanish network per se, although some programming along these lines. I was just fortunate enough a couple months ago to add the El Rey network, and I cannot say enough great things about Lucha Underground. So I highly suggest that to anyone who is fortunate enough to have that network. But gentlemen, a pleasure as always to get the two of you guys in. Always great TV talk and talk about the business and the technology of where it's going. You just can't do any better than putting the two of you guys together to talk about this kind of stuff. A couple of gentlemen, both from Media Village, Stuart Elliott and our FDH Lounge dignitary, Simon Applebaum, also of Tomorrow Will Be Televised. Thank you so much, gentlemen. As always, I look forward to the next time we gather to do something like this.
Thank you. Likewise.
Thank you, Rick and Stuart. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Really appreciate it. Thank you guys both so much. This was awesome. Thank you, everybody, for tuning in to FDH Lounge mini episode number 730.
As we bring the show to a close, we would like to extend our deepest gratitude to NBC, CBS, ABC, Fox, All Clear Channel affiliates, TNT, TBS, USA, UPN, Deadspin.com, YouTube.com, YTMND.com, MySpace.com, various blogs, Fox News, CNN, CNBC, MSNBC, IamBored.com, Billboard.com, Google.com, ESPN, ESPN2, ESPN News, ESPN Classic, NBA TV, NFL Network, Sports Time Ohio, Athlon Magazine, Comedy Central, Cartoon Network, The Boomerang Channel, QVC, BET, The Spice Channel, Steno Notebooks, Manwich, Papermate Office Supplies, Waitresses, Strippers, Bartenders, Garbage Men, Janitors, Microwave Popcorn, The Writers of The Office, Scrubs, Entourage, My Name is Earl, Oz, Metalocalypse and the Boondocks, Awkwafina, and The Periodic Table of Elements.